Neuter Network, Companion Animal Foundation.
Hello and welcome to Thursday Night Talk. My name is Linda Stansberry, and I'm here with our first ever pet panel. This is very exciting. Tonight we're talking about all things hairy and waggy and meowy and barky and swimmy and flyy. I hope that gives you a good overview. I'm here with Ben Gordon, who's a local canine behavior and who owns a company called Canine Behavior and Training Solutions. He is a dog expert. Pam Brown, who is getting the Arcata Dog Park off the ground, so to speak. And Shannon Townsend, who's a volunteer with the Humboldt Spay Neuter Network. Welcome, guys.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Good
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Hey, also in the studio, we have Jemmy, the feral kitten, which Shannon brought in with us. Thank you for bringing this cute little kitten.
My pleasure.
Awesome. All right. Well, guys, tonight we are talking about pets in Humboldt. It is a big, big subject. So, first of all, I have a practical question for you, and Ben, this might be for you. I have a dog. He is very timid. He came from a ranch where other dogs are beating him up. Now, what is the etiquette when I'm out walking and someone has their dog off the leash and he comes over and menaces my dog? How do I handle this?
Oh, my gosh. That's such a big question. I have countless clients that ask that question often. It's just a very difficult situation because we're in such a rural We live in such a rural place where the lifestyle of owning a dog is different than that in an urban environment, at least in my experience, right? So in an urban environment, in the big cities I've lived in, there are leash laws. They're maintained. The only place your dog's allowed to be off-leash generally is in an off-leash dog park. Here, we have so many dogs off the leash all the time. And so in terms of etiquette, I think it's very, very difficult to sort of make some overall statements about what everybody should do, aside from the fact that what's safest for all pets, in my opinion, is for all pets to be on leashes unless they're in a place that where it's appropriate for the dog to be off leash, because at least in that situation, someone like you who has a dog that maybe has some special needs wouldn't go to a place that's off leash, right? Because you don't know how your dog's going to be able to deal with the social anxieties that your dog is experiencing, whereas you know that you could take your dog someplace on leash and perhaps work your dog through those issues, or at least your dog doesn't get triggered as often, right? So I think it's a big question. It's a difficult one. It's one that I struggle with also, right? Because I train a lot of dogs that have behavioral issues, insecurity or reactivity on the leash. I just got a new puppy. I want to be able to take my puppy places that are safe for my puppy as well. And it's difficult when there are off-leash dogs, rogue dogs. I had that situation actually today, working with a client in a place where all dogs are supposed to be off-leash, and here comes this big old dog running up to him who's not neutered. The owner's calling him, but not doing much else. And so, you know, if my client's dog happened to be reactive, or anybody's dog happens to be reactive or nervous or insecure, we could have a problem. So anyway, it's difficult.
I've heard of that, and I know it probably wouldn't work all together too well up here, but the yellow ribbon tied on the leash as a universal sign that your dog isn't friendly with other dogs. I've just seen that on Facebook. People have shared that. But then again, when I think about it, you know, not you. You guys don't look like you've never heard of that. So, yeah, I shout right away. Hey, is your dog friendly? My dog's not. Or, you know, my dog was attacked one time off leash, and it was a really traumatic experience for both of us. And so now I do. They do like to be off leash. So there's a park that we go to that's not a dog park, but it's like a du jour dog park or whatever.
It's a bespoke dog park.
Right. Yeah. And Linda probably knows what I'm talking about because she's my neighbor as well. But when I see new dogs, I try to get the owner's attention right away just to see if they're friendly.
Yeah, I really like that strategy. If I can just, you know, so like in terms of what kind of strategy could you adopt? The only one is really preemptive, I think. You know, the only one is, you know, you go out with a plan, regardless of what might happen out there, you're prepared to let people know, hey, it's not okay for your dog to approach my dog, and you have some sort of exit strategy. So I really like that. I mean, really, it seems like it's upon each person to be able to keep themselves and their dog safe. So, yeah, I agree with that.
I've seen dogs in our neighborhood loose, and I just start yelling. You call your, get your dog. Sometimes people come out, and sometimes they don't. But it draws attention. People pay attention.
So there isn't really anything we can do to stop it in a particular situation, but I'm wondering if there's efforts we can make. Like, I ran into this in the forest with my dog just a couple days ago, and this dog rushed out, growled, barked, and I just yelled and put my hand out, "No," really loud, and "Stop." So it stopped, it continued to growl and bark. There must be something we can do if we don't have a small dog we can pick up.
If I'm understanding what you're referring to, you're saying each individual, there's got to be some strategy that you can adopt. I think that certainly there are, right? There are ways and means to protect yourself. There are a lot of variables in how a dog may react, an off-leash dog may react, right? So the strategy that you adopt may keep you safe one time, but it may get you into trouble another, right? So for instance, if you have a dog that's intending to do you harm, and you react in an aggressive manner, you may actually incite a reaction, right?
Okay.
Stuff like that. Now, I'm certainly not saying don't do that. It's just a very difficult topic because each altercation and each, you know, unit of dogs is different. There's a whole constellation of things that make up behavior, reaction, that includes everybody that's involved. So it's difficult. I like the idea of being prepared with your dog in any way that you can be. So first and foremost, I would say, and it may actually even seem cliche, but first and foremost, having strong obedience with your dog is the number one way, in my opinion, that you're going to be able to head off as many different altercations as you may have. If your dog is under voice control, let's say, you're going to be able to avoid a lot of different issues. You may not be able to avoid the issue where the dog who's approaching you is intending to do your dog harm. Then obedience isn't going to do you any good. You're going to need to let your dog protect themselves, in my opinion, right? Mm-hmm. However, there are many situations in which I can tell my dog down. I know my dog's going to stay there. I can put myself in between the dog that's coming, right? And or I can do whatever it is that I need to do to keep my dog safe in that period of time, because I don't have to worry now about what my dog's going to do. So first and foremost, I would say obedience, strong obedience, is a great first step in trying to keep yourself safe and keep your dog safe.
So what you're saying is basically if you coach your dog or if you work with your dog to be obedient and have strong voice commands, that's going to help prevent it being injured by people whose dogs aren't so obedient. And that kind of gets to the heart of what I want to talk about is this phrase, you know, there are no bad pets, there are only bad owners. The incident I was thinking about with my dog is I was walking in our neighborhood, Shannon, and this person had like a gigantic dog wandering like, I don't know, like half a block away from their house. And I yelled down to him. I was like, "So, hey, is this your dog? Is this your dog wandering without a leash, you know, right up here on the sidewalk?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah. Thank you for telling me." And because they don't like other dogs.
Oh, like, my gosh.
Are you kidding me? I was so mad. You know, there's only so much we can police other people's responsiveness with their pets, right? So yeah. How do we create a better community?
I take my dogs to, Eureka Dog Park, and most often to, Moonstone Beach or Hiller, because the dogs can run free in an open area there. And then I walk on the trails. And one time, I've never had a bad experience there with any dog in 3 years, but one time I'm walking across the trail, and they're pretty narrow, and a dog gets aggressive with my dog. And I start yelling right away, and the owner is there in less than 5 seconds, grabs his dog. And I just thought, it's all about the owners. Because I've talked to other people at Hiller and other places where their dogs have been attacked. And the owner just says, "Oh, let the dogs work it out." Or they're nonplussed. They don't get off the park bench to help out. So for me, it's first and foremost got to be about the owner being vigilant. There's someone who goes to Hiller who's just wonderful, and he has two pretty big dogs. He's always got them on a halter and leashes, and he's training them, like you said, Ben, because they're learning, the rescue dogs, and he wants them to learn how to be social, and there's dogs there. He's so good about it. He's on top of it the whole time. So I want to say owners are just so critical in the mix of dogs coming together. It's like you said, Ben, they have to have control over their dog, but also when something happens to intervene and take responsibility for it.
I don't have control over my dog. Actually, well, one I do, but our little foster fail, Sweetie Muffin, our little pit bull mix, she's very friendly and she loves everyone and she thinks everyone wants to play with her and loves her and no recall whatsoever. So I'm listening to you and I'm inspired to do some more training with her because she... We rescued her out of Hoopa. And, she just loves everyone. She doesn't want to hurt any dogs, but she does look scary if she's running towards you, you know? Even the little imaginary hearts are just coming out of her head.
Yeah, she'll kill you with kindness. She's very sweet. That's how you and I met, Shannon, actually, is I was working on a story for the North Coast Journal about the strays issue in Hoopa. Can you tell us a little bit about that, like what the situation is up there?
Right. The Hoopa area in like Wichipec and basically Orleans as well, east of the 101, east of us here in northern Humboldt. There is a lack of resources out there, as we all know. I mean, for other things as well, but for animals, the rescue groups that we have here in Humboldt are all focused around Arcata and Eureka mainly. And I know for just Hoopa, they don't have an animal shelter. They don't have a contract with our county shelter. They don't have their own animal shelter. They do have an ordinance that does lay the groundwork to have a shelter. So that's something that hopefully we could look forward to. But there is definitely a problem of unwanted dogs in Hoopa. There was a rescue out there for a little while, but I'm not sure how active they are right now. They're called the Greater Rural Rescue Society, and it was two lovely ladies, Kathleen and Denise, who just were trying to help as much as they can. But there's a neuter scooter that goes out to tribal lands that does spaying and neutering and vaccines, and they go all over the country. And they, unfortunately, the day that Linda and I went out there, the vet was sick. But she actually just was out there recently, and they spayed, she spayed one vet with like one or two techs. They neutered 75 animals in one day. But she works like from 7 a.m. to 12 a.m. the next day. Anyways, when you drive around there, at least when I go out there, I see dogs running loose all over. I don't see as many cats, but I know they're there. They're hiding.
They gotta hide.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's, for some of us, we take for granted, you know, the hard work that's accomplished by volunteers and by, you know, government organizations, spaying, neutering. Animal control. These like India and Guatemala, third world countries where it's common just to see packs of stray dogs, you know, all over the streets. So we have a really good established infrastructure here to take care of that. But I think a lot of that work is hidden. It relies on volunteers and grants. And it's from what I've seen, it's pretty underfunded. I don't know what you guys have noticed.
I agree with that, Linda. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, the rescues are really overworked. I talked to, you know, people with, well, Humboldt Spay and Companion Animal and Redwood Pals Rescue and Buddy's Angels, just to name a few. We have quite a few rescues up here. We are very lucky in that sense that we have so many rescues that are so committed and connected to helping the community's animals. But there's a sense of, like, exhaustion sometimes, especially around certain times of the year. Like, right now is kitten season, and I can tell you I'm pretty exhausted. I love it, though. I wouldn't ask for anything else. But we definitely need more funding and more, I don't know, more donors, more public funds going towards our shelter system would help. Something's got to change because... you know, we live in a very rural community, and it's very, you know, low income, unfortunately. And so with that comes, you know, a lack of resources or a lack of housing, a lack of access to for people to keep their animals in their house with them. And we all want to have animals. I mean, it's very popular. I mean, at least most households now have at least one dog or a cat. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Thank you for the work you do. It's critical. And I can imagine that people would feel burned out caring for the animals, right? Not
yeah.
just the funding for spaying and neutering, but just caring for them, waiting for them to have a home and have them lingering until they can get one, especially animals that have grown up not being taken care of. They haven't experienced that love and affection and caring and, yeah, warmth and safety and security.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It's definitely tough.
I just wanted to interrupt real quick and let you guys know that you are listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. I'm your host, Linda Stansberry, and we are talking pets, strays, dogs, cats, anything you can think of. And we will take your calls. Just call in at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. So we've talked about dogs, and I would like to hear a little bit more about this dog park in Arcata, Pam.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. We are a group that have been working for soon 3 years with the city of Arcata. And when we started in 2010, there actually was a needs assessment done back in probably 2009 that said a dog park was needed. And that was done in focus groups, surveys, outreach, all over the community, that people wanted a dog park, dog owners and non-dog owners. And then last year, we were able to get a goal for the 14-15 City Council, and that was coordinate with other city departments to identify potential sites for a dog park. This year, the goals or projects, as they're calling it, is to get site control. So that's a step forward, right, that we will have a site by the end of 2016. That's the intention, you know, goals are. And then the other part of that is to create a development plan for use of the D Street Linear Park while continuing to explore the potential of Little Lake's property. And that's given a high priority, and all this falls under the sort of newly developed Environmental Services, Community Services Department. So we're focused on only on the Little Lake property. We did an assessment 2 years ago. It was extensive of all the property identified by the city that could be used for a dog park. And it's the only place we found that had potential, both in terms of size and location. And so we've been meeting with the city manager now monthly. And the most recent development, which is not a surprise to most people, is that they need to do a study to find out about the level of dioxin, the toxicity level. And they've contracted with, I think it's Freshwater Contamination or Freshwater Environmental Services. And just in 2 weeks, we'll meet again with Karen Diemer, who's city manager. She's been great to work with, to find out what their timeline is. And that's really going to be great for us, because once that's done, then we can really move forward with hopefully getting site control. If the contamination, depending on the levels, is pretty high, then the city, along with the environmental work that's being done, needs to be decided if they'll cap it or if it has to be removed. It can be very expensive to remove it. And so we're waiting to find out about that. We have a website, arcatadogpark.com. I think it's .com. Anyway, if you Google Arcata Dog Park, I send updates out on that pretty regularly. And then we have a Facebook page, Arcata Dog Park. Try to keep people posted. And we've learned a lot from the folks who worked for 15 years on the Eureka Dog Park. Took less than a year for the Fortuna Dog Park. So we're hoping somewhere in between those two.
So we understand, as dog owners, we understand, like, how nice it is to have a dog parks, but what are the benefits for a community?
Well, one of the biggest benefits for non-dog owners is the reduced contamination of other areas.
You mean less dog poop?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, I forgot to mention, I and someone else in the dog park working group, we service two of the doggy pot stations at the Arcata Marsh, usually every week. Empty the trash and fill the poop bag boxes so it's there.
I always wondered who did that. Oh my gosh, you're an angel.
Thank you. Anything to get a dog park. So, yeah, less contamination. It's better for the wildlife, birds, mammals. It's safer for people who are walking, who are afraid of dogs or don't want to interact with dogs. Hiller Park, I mentioned before, it's not fenced. It's a great place, but I'm always concerned because people are riding their bikes on the path when they go by. Some have small kids in a stroller or a little four-year-old walking along, and they're not protected. Really, if something was to happen, if a dog was to get rambunctious, not necessarily aggressive. So I think it's really good for non-dog owners. For dog owners, and I've been to parks throughout California, all the way down to Laguna Beach and then up to Portland. It gives a sense of community that's pretty sweet. You know, dog owners are a little engaged with their dogs. Like, they usually love them, right? It's a lot, as you guys know, mm-hmm. who have dogs and train dogs. And so it's sort of like going and watching kids play tennis or adults play tennis or soccer games or the type of community that gets built when you watch go out and watch adult baseball. You feel like you're part of something. And dog parks do this too. The regulars, you get to know each other.
I was going to say, yeah. I meet people and they're dogs first. And, you know, you introduce dogs first, right?
Yeah,
that's what and then you gradually get to know the human's name. But, yeah, it's kind of funny.
No, it's great you bring that up. It's true. You're just when you're walking down the street, people go, oh, what a cute dog. What kind uh-huh. of dog? And the next thing you know, you're having a conversation with someone.
Oh, yeah.
You just would have walked by.
I always tell my single friends they can borrow my dogs anytime.
If they get lonely, I want to have a conversation.
You want to meet someone? It's, like, easy.
A confession to make. You mentioned poop earlier. Okay, so as a caveat, I got to tell you guys, like, I grew up in the sticks, and, you know, we just let our dogs kind of do their thing, run wild. So, but I noticed the other day, I was walking my dog with Shannon, and she is very scrupulous about picking up her dog poop, which I appreciate, but I had always thought, like, if it's a vacant lot, or, like, just, like, a random, like, you just, you know, side of the road or something like that, not a place where humans would usually go, it was fine to leave your dog poop there. But I got the idea from Shannon that maybe my etiquette was not on par. Ben, what do you think?
I think it's always a good idea to clean up after your dog. You know, it prevents disease. You know, it's certainly, you know, feces is biodegradable. You could make that argument. Or if it's in a vacant lot, then, you know, who's it harming? But I think that, you know, I think it's just a good practice to be into no matter where you are, you know. And if you do any walking on any of the trails, especially in McKinleyville, which I do a lot, you know, it's just needed. I mean, it's just needed. I mean, it gets to be, you know, we all need to do our part. If we, you know, my opinion is, like, doing my part is part of me being hopeful that everybody else is going to do their part so that, you know, we can walk on a trail without having to worry about stepping off the trail into feces or whatever. But I think there are a lot of good reasons to do it, and I think that being vigilant about it is just a good sort of a good way to move through the world.
And from a stormwater perspective as well, mm-hmm. I know that the North Coast Stormwater Coalition has these really neat little posters, and one is a guy holding a dog, and they're on a beach right in the water, you know, and showing that that stuff does go downstream, and that, you know, it does affect wildlife, and we are a fisheries dependent community, so it all kind of connects. And, you know, of course you think, oh, it's just this one time or it's just this one dog, but if you look at it on a larger scale, and although I will admit there is one house in our neighborhood that I don't pick it up, it's a vacant house.
Okay.
I'll say. You know which one.
Yeah. Actually, there's a house in our neighborhood that has a sign that's a picture of a dog with dog pooping with an X through it, you know, saying, like, don't let your dog poop on my lawn. And the first time I took my dog for a walk, that's where he went. I was like, oh, no.
When we were advocating with the city to install more doggy pot stations for people so that they could, you know, actually pick up their dog waste, I walked along the one side of Klop Lake with a friend who was up here from San Diego. I thought, well, this will be entertaining for him to count the piles I picked up. And then before I could get to the end of just that one length on the bay side, we picked up over 100 piles.
Wow.
It's just, it's good to pick it up because people who don't have dogs, too, will become more receptive to dogs being out walking, but... it is. It means you got to have the bags. You got to always remember them. You know, there are.
And you got to see it.
And you got. What do you mean, see
well,
it?
Well, at the dog park.
Oh, right. Yes.
I see it. And I don't want to. Sometimes I'm like, oh, how do I tell them that their dog
I
went
know.
Potty down there? And so I had a funny thing happen at our Eureka dog park about a month ago. A gal, I thought her dog went, and I told her. And she was like, well, I hate picking up cold poop. So if this is cold, I'm going to be pissed. And it was cold. It was the funniest thing. I was like, what's that? Warm,
as opposed
cold?
To picking up warm poop? Like, yeah. That makes no sense.
So, but sometimes if I can't find mine, sometimes if there's in the grass or something, I'll find another one and I'll pick it up and I'll feel okay. I'm like, okay, I did my good.
Oh, that's nice.
It's cold.
You're right, though. You have to watch your dog all the time to see. And especially
yeah,
at Eureka
they're
Dog
tricky.
Park.
They're sneaky.
Dip. Mm-hmm. They can be on the other side. And if you don't walk over and you don't see where it's happening, you're not going to pick it up. So there is an overabundance at the Eureka Dog Park. So I wish people would be a little more vigilant about following their dog. But, you know, you get there, like I said, it's a sense of community. And you start talking to people, you know, and your dog wanders off and you're talking to somebody about dogs. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, Ben, this can be kind of sensitive, you know, talking to other people on, you know, how to take care of their dogs. And you train dogs. Do you spend time training owners as well?
Well, that's the hard part, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, the dogs are all pretty straightforward, right? But yeah, I mean, everybody learns differently, right? So there's always that challenge. And people have preconceived ideas, of course, right? And all I have is my experience, right? So I try to relate my experience as much as I can, having been doing this for a really long time. And I make suggestions, but I try to help people just sort of find the path that's going to work best for them. Some people, you know, trying to push people to challenge their preconceived ideas or challenge their... the things that they just don't believe in doesn't seem to serve the dog as well. I think somewhere along the line, I realized that if I wanted to serve the dogs the best that I possibly could, that I had to be able to develop some sort of relationship with the owner that was going to help them to move forward, regardless of how fast or slow I thought. They should move. I wanted them to just be able to continue to work with the dog. So, you know, the dogs are the ones that suffer if we as dog trainers can't communicate. There are a lot of, and I'm not putting myself in any particular class, there are a lot of very skilled dog trainers. And it seems now that we're starting to get more skilled communicators, because it doesn't really matter how good of a dog trainer I am. If I can't communicate with you, if I can't help you make progress, if I can't support you, and kind of outline what's realistic, right? And always emphasize practice. Like, we're not going to perfect this. We're going to practice this over time, because it takes time to develop a dog like it takes time to develop a child, right? And they go through all of those maturation periods like children do. So training the owner is very difficult. And it's very often that I get the question, do you train husbands? Do you train children? Do you train? And my reply is always yes, but it's far more expensive. So, you know,
more difficult.
More difficult for sure. But, you know, dog training and behavior modification, those, it's a practice like anything else. And it takes time and it takes commitment to practice those things. And also, I think it should be looked at. Oftentimes, finances, so when you hire a private dog trainer, oftentimes finances sort of dictate, I think, people's ideas about how long dog training should go, right? Because it's expensive to hire somebody privately. And in a group class, there's a lot of attrition, because it can be frustrating. You've got one trainer for eight people and eight dogs, and all those people are novices. So it can be kind of frustrating for people. So they either, you know, even if it's inexpensive, maybe they're not getting the care that they need just because of the environment or whatever. So I think in a lot of cases, people have this like finite idea of how long dog training should go. But we're teaching perishable skills. Dogs don't come along with the need to sit or the need to down for any period of time, and the need to come to you every time you call them. Like, those are things we require, right? And they're skills that we can teach over time, but they're perishable. So if we don't continue to practice them, even with a dog that's been in training for a long time, you may get more of the behavior that stays, right? Let's say with a dog that's been trained from 8 weeks to 5 years and then you don't train anymore, maybe you'll have more. Right. But the bottom line is that those things fall away, just like algebra from high school or any class that you took any time that you don't practice anymore. You know, that stuff doesn't stay. So
I just want to mention to our listeners that you can call in at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. This is Thursday Night Talk. We are talking pets, and we have a pet panel with Ben Gordon, who is a dog trainer with Canine Behavior and Training Solutions, Pam Brown, who is getting the Arcata Dog Park going, and Shannon Townsend, who's a volunteer with Humboldt Spay Neuter Network. Again, those numbers are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911, and we welcome your calls.
I have a question for Ben. Do you use, like, reward-based training?
Always. Like, you know, when I first started dog training in the 80s,
And that long.
Late 80s, and then into early 90s, the only methods of training are what we call the traditional methods of training, right? And they were really all based in force. Those were the best ideas we had at the time, and they were used for a really long time. Choke chains, 6-foot leashes. Nobody used food back then. If you did, they kind of laughed you out of it, right? Like, if you were a dog trainer that used food back then, you weren't considered a dog trainer. You didn't really know what you were doing. They were based on all these ideas that you had to dominate the dog and you had to be in charge and all of this other stuff. And there were people that were skilled at it, but it was hard. It was hard on the dog, right? And somewhere like in the early 90s, late 90s, and Pam and I were discussing someone, actually I'll mention in a second, dog training sort of got the shot in the arm from academia, from some of the actual veterinary behavior, or actual academically trained behaviors, those that had degrees in animal psychology, and also from those people that were training exotic animals. They sort of got, there was this crossover that happened, and a lot of the exotic animal trainers and behaviorists started to sort of say, hey, you know, you don't need to be doing that. You know, we don't put choke chains on dolphins. We don't put choke chains on, you know, we don't do those things. You can't do that with a lion. Here's what we do. And so the ideas of psychology came in, like operant conditioning, people like B.F. Skinner, people that, you know, you study, let's say, in any psychology degree. The ideas of learning theory were then sort of injected into dog training. There was this huge movement to the left where people started to use food. And then all of a sudden we started to see this huge, like, uptick in what dogs could do. So on, you know, if you have on your Facebook feed anything about dogs, you're seeing these amazing things that dogs can do, right? Like, it's amazing, like, how many things dogs can do. And so, yeah, so anyway, yes, food-motivated obedience is always the best, but it's not the only thing. And there are going to be holes. So, you know, we want to be able to use food effectively, and at some point we may need to use some force, but you have to sort of earn that right and understand how that's applicable and what's fair. So,
sorry. I just want to say we do have a call from Jean in Eureka. Jean, go ahead.
Okay. I kind of wanted to address an earlier issue that was brought up about in particular about older dog owners at risk from other people's dogs. I've had dogs all my life. I consider myself a really responsible owner. I pick up after her, and she happens to be exceedingly well-trained and compliant. But I had a recent happenstance on a beach, on a local small beach, about a year ago, and she was with me, and there was one other person who had two large dogs with him. All of them were off-leash, and at one point, I was walking up the beach with her and turned around to see what was going on, and these two dogs were 2 seconds away from me and barreled into me and knocked me over and rearranged my spine. And after I visited various doctors, I was told that this is not an uncommon occurrence. And I think it comes down to protecting oneself. I now carry a cane everywhere. It's good for hooking into my dog's collar for an emergency leash, should it be required. It's good for shaking at another dog that's coming close to me. And believe me, I'm up against a fence anytime there's more than one dog on the premises. I just have to, because another fall would be really damaging to me. And I know I'm not alone in this. We who are older don't want activities out in the world with our pets. But this is a clear and present danger. Anytime there are a pack of dogs or whatever, you know, even if they know each other, it can be a threat. There are loose leashes. People are hanging on to them and not paying attention where they are in relationship to people. It's kind of hazardous. So I have found that a cane is my best resource for both protection and support. So at that, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. That sounds like a really traumatizing experience.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened.
Awesome. Yeah, me too, Jean. And it happened to me at Hiller Park. Just, you know, dogs playing, and they were running, and I tried to get out of the way and didn't get away in time. I guess that's another really beautiful idea with the dog park. It's such a resource. Like when I go to the one in Eureka, I'm like you. I'm either sitting down, or I'm near the fence, or I'm near a tree, and being vigilant all the time. So it can happen with an innocent dog playing as well. So, yeah, figuring that out is really, really important. But I think a dog park helps, because there's always benches and there's always a fence to back into.
Yeah, I feel the same. That reminds me, one time I ran into a lady walking her dog at Headwaters Park in Eureka, and she had a cattle prod on her for defense or for other dogs. I couldn't believe it, but... some people have had traumatic experiences in the past, and, you know, I understand where they're coming from. Yeah, I'm always looking out as well at the dog park, too, and just kind of looking behind me, and, you know.
There was a woman the other day at Hiller Park that said to me, it was at Clam Beach, and she said, bend your knees. I always bend my knees so that if you do get knocked into, at least your knees are going to be okay. So I thought, well, that was good advice.
Yeah. You know, I had a good friend of mine, and this just came to my mind. I won't mention her name, but she was viciously attacked earlier this year by two dogs at Clam Beach. Mm-hmm. And she had to go through the whole series of rabies shots, and the owner was completely unresponsible and ran away, you know, so she couldn't press charges. And, I mean, I saw the pictures, and it was horrible. And, I've heard about quite a few of those cases, you know, where dogs are attacking people in our community, and it's scary.
Well, I'm just recalling something that happened to me about 7 years, where I had an acquaintance whose dog bit me on the thigh, and it was kind of a jumpy dog. I think it may have been there may have been an abuse situation there. That seems to be often the case with aggressive dogs, and they talked me out of pressing charges. Well, not pressing charges. They talked me out of reporting, you know, this case. And I said, you need to keep your dog on a leash. If I was a kid, you know, that would be right at, like, face level where it bit me. And I always regretted it, because it went on to bite someone else in the exact same spot and caused nerve damage. And at that point, you know, the dog was taken away and I think euthanized. But it kind of brings me to this point, which I wanted to talk about, is when do you report someone? You know, in cases of abuse, in cases of aggressive dogs, we're talking about relationships between people and their animals, which is a lot like a relationship with a child. Like, when do you butt in? What's the line?
I'd say right away.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's so important to report. A friend of mine whose dog was killed within, I don't know, seconds. It happened so fast. She was so traumatized, she couldn't report it. I even offered to report it for her. It's true, they can't keep documenting this if we don't report it. So I know it's hard once something like that happens. But yeah, I think it's really important. I agree with you.
Yeah, someone asked me what I thought about that question. They had witnessed an owner abusing their dog, someone that I know. And I said, why did you wait to ask me? You know, you saw them hitting their dog and you didn't say anything or make a call. And I think we're still kind of, as a society, developing the, you know, the knowledge and understanding for our animal counterparts. And you know, if you do witness abuse, you know, it's really good to get a video or pictures. I know I tend to want to intervene and say something, but sometimes getting documented evidence is really good as far as if it's criminal activity and it needs to be reported. I know I'm following a dog abuse case right now that's going on in the courts, and apparently the only reason why this is in court is because there was a video of it, and the person had been abusing their animals in the past. People had seen them in the community, had said things to them, but they were never charged with it until it was caught on video, a surveillance camera.
Well, I want to bring up again, you know, we have, Ben mentioned, you know, the positive reinforcement that goes into training an animal well. And I think, you know, all of us as experienced dog owners, well, I guess I would say I'm semi-experienced.
Yeah, me too.
we know what that looks like, but there are still a lot of people out there who believe in corporal punishment, you know, for their dogs or for their children. So at what point is that abuse? Is it always abuse?
I wanted to mention earlier, Ben, when you were talking about the patience it takes and how long and repeating things off and on, no matter how long a dog lives. And Meta Bryant is someone I've gone to the puppy classes with both my dogs when
Me
they
too.
Were puppies. And she always says, because I always get frustrated, like, you know, most of us do, trying to train a puppy. And she always would say, remember, you have to say it 1,000 times before they get it. And I thought that's such a beautiful guideline, just... Here comes this little creature who doesn't speak English, as you were saying, doesn't know any of the language that we have or the expectations, and it's so naive to think it'll just catch on and all we have to do is love it. I think a lot of people go into that,
right,
into a puppy relationship thinking that. And I had to really address that too. Some years ago, I thought, boy, for my age, I'm really naive. You have to be in control of yourself. And then I think training the puppy comes from a place of positive reinforcement. You never have to hit a puppy. You really don't. I mean, it's just positive reinforcement. But, gosh, it is so much work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I don't want to – well, one of the things I think I really need to point out is that it's my understanding – I could be wrong. I haven't looked at the statistics in a long time. But most bites that happen with a familiar dog, somebody that we know, a friend's dog, our own dogs, right? And so I think it's really important for people to understand. So we're talking about etiquette overall, right? And it's important for people to have a strong understanding, like a strong doggy IQ. Like, you know, dogs try to give all kinds of signs to us. It's just that they use body language primarily, sense of smell, right? Eye contact. We use words primarily, right? So what's happening is oftentimes they're signaling like crazy. Their mouth closes, their ears go up, their eyes get wide, their body stiffens before they bite, right? So there's lots and lots of cues, and people just don't seem to have a very good doggy IQ. Oh, your dog's so cute, let me pet him. And they lean right over in the dog's face, or they let their kid come up and hug the dog. Like, it happens often. So I wanted to mention that. The other thing I wanted to mention is that it's really important for everybody to know that there is a period of time, there's a maturation process that happens from weaning, 3-4 weeks old, up until 4.5 months or so when the dog starts to teethe, where naturally dogs teach each other bite inhibition because they resolve all of their conflicts with one another. If they were to remain in the pack structure, if you think of a feral or wild dog pack, they resolve all of their conflicts for the most part without damage. There is damage with mate attention and retention and sometimes with warding off other pack members, invading pack members. But try to understand that as a pack, they rely on one another for the whole pack to survive. So damaging each other doesn't work. So anyway, they teach each other. And we have an opportunity from 3 weeks to 4.5 months to teach our dogs bite inhibition. And it's one of the biggest things overlooked in puppy classes, in my opinion. There's lots of food-motivated obedience and socialization, but we don't teach owners, how do you transfer bite inhibition into your home? How do you teach your dog that touching with their teeth is absolutely not okay without putting the dog in conflict and punishing the dog? How do you communicate like another dog would? I think that's really important. And then the last thing I want to say, I'm trying to get through this quick because I don't want to hijack the conversation, but I think it's really important. From my perspective as a dog trainer and behaviorist, and I think it's pretty much accepted now, once your dog breaks the skin, once they've punctured somebody else, it's no longer whether or not it basically comes down to a management issue, right? So if you don't, if your dog has never broken the skin but has shown some reaction, you have a reactive dog, possibly an aggressive dog, there's a possibility we can extinguish that behavior and the dog may never break the skin. But if you're somebody who has a dog who has already broken the skin, the odds are that the dog will break the skin again if they reach critical mass. Right? They didn't learn bite inhibition at the right time or whatever. So if they've broken the skin, it's now a management issue. It's no longer about let the dog loose and see how the dog does. Maybe he won't break the skin this time. It's more about hypervigilance. It's more about management and making sure that I'm not only keeping my dog safe, but everybody else, because I know that he's bitten before and the odds are he's going to bite again. So I think it's really important for everybody to understand that dogs don't have a lot of choices. They're basically second-class citizens. They are, you know, they do whatever it is we deem is right or not right. But there are a lot of things that we can do to aid them and hopefully keep them from being in those situations.
That's a good point, Ben. And I wanted to remind our listeners, you can call in at 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911, KHSU. We do have a call waiting. It's Todd from Orleans. Todd, go ahead.
Hi. I'm experiencing a problem that involves both dogs and cats. We've had a recent experience with rabies, and I am one of those pet owners, cat owner, that owns a bunch. I grew up with dogs. Always had them immunized, vaccinated, all these kind of things. I'm wondering about, as you talk about animal bites, what are the implications if you have an epidemic such as rabies that can be transmitted through just normal animal interaction?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think it's a really good question for your local vet. You know, like if I, anytime there's a medical question.
We have no local vet. This is, we totally lack facilities where I live.
Okay. Or, you know, you might be able to find maybe one of the other panel members has the answer. I don't.
Hi, Todd. It's Shannon. I've spoken to you before.
Yes.
Nice to hear from you again. As I told you, I know I feel for you so much being out in New Orleans and not having a veterinarian nearby and with the constraints that you're dealing with. And I just wanted to remind everyone and our listeners that an organization that I'm involved with, Companion Animal Foundation, is actively fundraising to purchase a mobile RV to go to people like Todd out in Orleans and in Hoopa and Wichpec areas and provide at least monthly or quarterly vet services because
you have been very responsive to this. I'm wondering the implications of what about when the situation is on the ground.
So you're worried about your cats or other animals in the area contracting rabies, is that right?
Sure.
Well, none of us are particularly experts on rabies. I do understand that it doesn't transmit easily to cats, although, of course, I'm guessing there's a chance, so that's not very reassuring.
Well, what I've heard is cats aren't the best vector for it. Dogs and bats are more so. I think this is an animal control issue, personally. That's what I believe. I think animal control should be active in doing preventative measures to prevent situations such as this.
We get very little response from animal control in places, you know.
And I know, and there's a lot of things that need to change, like the local ordinances with our county say everything about dogs and rabies. They say nothing about cats and rabies.
Mm-hmm.
You're required to have your dog vaccinated and licensed, but there's nothing about cats. Mm-hmm. And that's something that needs to change, and that needs to come, you know, from the top down with our, you know, board of supervisors. And
thank you for addressing that.
Yeah, I want to help you more, Todd. I still am trying to think about creative ways to go out there and visit with you, and maybe Linda and I might make a field trip out there and try to bring some resources out to you, or at least take some of your cats to a rescue or to get vaccinated and fixed.
I appreciate your time and all your thought.
And that brings up a good point.
You've been so good at it. I know it's a overwhelming thing, and we just live in unusual circumstances.
Right.
Here.
Yeah. Every rural area has the same problem.
The situation that you didn't foresee.
Todd, we do have another caller from Southern Humboldt on the line. I bet they have some similar issues. Thank you, Todd.
Thanks,
have a nice day.
Thank you, Todd.
And we do have Gunasini from Southern Humboldt on the line.
Great. Hi there. Thanks for the great show. Hey, I'm looking for some training tips about dogs who don't have the healthy fear that's necessary of cars. Seems like I know a lot of dogs who just like to hang out around cars. You know, I'll pull down my driveway and the dog will come right out to the car and oftentimes, you know, be so close that I'm concerned about hitting it. I've got several neighbors with this issue. I actually have a neighbor whose dog was hit by another neighbor. You know, the dog was hanging out under the car. I'm just wondering how to train. Why do dogs love to be around cars so much, and how can we train them to have that healthy fear? Stay back.
I think it's a great question. So if I understand your question, I want to make sure I understand your question. Your concern is that there are many dogs around where you live, and you're afraid you're going to hit one because they don't seem to have any concern about vehicles. Is that accurate?
Exactly.
I see. I think it's a great question. I think it's one that a lot of people deal with. It's very, very difficult to train somebody else's dog. Mm-hmm. You know, a wild dog, let's say a feral dog, a dog that's just kind of lives off the land, or even a dog that just sort of is free to roam. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I have any specific suggestions other than being very, very careful like you are, or, you know, possibly laying on your horn, something like that, mm-hmm. that is going to teach the dog to keep a healthy boundary around your vehicle. Like, if it was your own dog,
yeah.
Or sometimes we have dogs that that vehicles stimulate the prey drive, so the vehicle moves and the dog wants to chase it. Like,
right.
So those are practical things that we can do with our own dog. There are practical things we can do with our own dogs to modify that behavior pattern. But in terms of dogs that didn't develop any kind of concern or awareness mm-hmm. that vehicles can hurt them or kill them,
yeah.
I don't know that there's anything specific aside from, you know, loud noise a lot of times can be really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the old days, years and years ago, one of the things we used to use when we had, and I'm not necessarily advocating this, I need to make this really, really clear. I hope there's not a whole bunch of people walking around Humboldt doing this, but one of the things you can do is, you know, the boat horns, the handheld boat horns. If your car horn doesn't work, sometimes sticking that handheld boat horn out your window might work. But, it's a difficult situation. I think, you know, unfortunately, just being aware of your surroundings and being vigilant is the best way to go. I don't wish I had some bit more practical solutions for you, but I really don't.
Okay, that's actually helpful, the idea of the horn. I know I've tried, like, peppermint spray and tried to kind of spray the dog's face. One dog that was chasing me didn't really work, though.
Yeah, I think I think it's a really good point that I just want to address with you and everybody else that's listening, because we've had a few conversations where the idea of sort of like conflict, like force, like somebody said that in order to keep themselves safe, they needed to use a cane. And I'm not pro, you know, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. We all have to do what we have to do to keep ourselves safe. And now I'm talking about something that would create avoidance in a dog, right? And we're
right.
talking about how to keep our dogs safe. I think it's really important to understand that anytime we do anything that's going to create conflict with a dog we don't know, we run the risk of inciting a violent reaction from the dog. It's
okay.
really important to understand that.
Uh-huh.
You don't know how the dog is going to behave. So when we choose those methods, whether they're appropriate or not, we need
yeah.
to do them with the understanding that we may be creating a problem where there isn't a problem. So it's just one thing I want to make sure, you know, your question kind of led into it. I want to make sure that I say it out loud, you know, over the year, that it's just really important to know that it's not always predictable how a dog's going to react. So you need to be careful.
Yeah. Well, would you say, I know you mentioned that you had advice for dog owners, actually. You know, I have a dog that lives in my house that it's, you know, a neighbor's dog, but it's at my house that just tends to just be under my car when I go to start my car, or, you know, if I turn off the engine and when I'm coming home, the dog's just right there. And if I started up again, I'm always concerned I'm going to hit him. Well, what would you do with a dog that is your dog?
Yeah, so when we have an established behavior pattern like you're talking about,
yeah.
And when I say an established behavior pattern, I mean the dog's been doing it for a little while and it's something that they find comfort in, or for whatever reason they continue to do it, it's already a behavior that is there, right? So
right.
We're talking about extinguishing a behavior like that, in other words, getting rid of it. There's a long process involved. First and foremost, we need to manage the dog in such a way that they don't have the opportunity to continue to practice the behavior we want to get rid of,
uh-huh.
Right? So if I have a dog that's jumping up on people all the time, and I know it's not exactly like your issue,
uh-huh.
And I want to fix that, I want to extinguish that, and I want to teach the dog an alternative behavior. So I want to, when I say extinguish, I mean I want to get rid of it. I don't want the dog to do it anymore. And where the hole is, in other words, where the dog used to greet by jumping, I want to teach the dog something else, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't continue to let the dog jump on people while I'm trying to train this process. Because if I do, then it's kind of like the slot machine effect. The dog starts to figure out who he can jump on and who he can't, or he starts to realize, well, if I'm behind him, he can't jump up because I might give him some sort of consequence. So basically, when we're dealing with behavior problems, management is the first thing. We need to stop the dog from having the opportunity to do it when we're not able to intervene. So that's your first step, right? And that can be difficult for some people if they don't have a fenced yard, the dog's not crate trained, or the dog can't be in the house by themselves. That would be the first thing. The second thing then would be teaching the dog an alternative behavior first. Mm-hmm. And I don't exactly know what that would look like. We'd have to talk further, like what would be an alternative, maybe, you know, laying on a bed somewhere. Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to wrap this up, but laying on a bed somewhere close to the vehicle or on the front yard or whatever, and that's mm-hmm. the place that the dog's allowed to be. Mm-hmm. Then I would set the dog up, because I'm managing now when the dog has access to the vehicle, when they don't, right? Because
yeah.
I'm managing the environment. I'd set the dog up to make a mistake. In other words, I'd let him go into the car, and then I would let him know, nope, can't do that. Right? So there's some sort of consequence for that. But you can go lie on your bed
right.
because we've already taught that. And then it would reinforce that. And then it would
okay.
be the practice over time.
Mm-hmm.
Of,
to give them an alternative.
Right.
And then
but I think
with them.
Manage with any behavior problem, mm-hmm. behavior problems and dog training are not exactly the same thing. Behavior problem is psychology. Dog training is sort of like teaching a language.
Mm-hmm.
They intertwine, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
With any behavior problem, management is always the first thing. If you continue to let the dog practice, it's not going to get any better.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick, our local animal shelter is full with dogs and cats. They don't have any more room. A local rescue called Friends for Life Animal Rescue administers the emergency medical fund for all of the animals that enter our shelter. Each animal is allotted $250. That's it. That can be a spay for a big dog. It's bone dry. So basically, these animals that are entering our shelter, most animals entering our animal shelter are in time of crisis. They've been hit by cars. They've been neglected. They've been abused. They have mange. They're pregnant. They need to be fixed. They have a variety of issues. If they cost more than $250, they can be put to sleep. So I'm encouraging community members to donate to our emergency medical fund. You can go to dogrescuers.org and hit the donate button at the top left side of the website. You can donate to send checks directly to our animal shelter. Please get the word out that we need some more funds for that, because like you're talking about dogs being hit by cars, that happens every day.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all of our callers. We need to wrap up. So again, I want to thank Ben with Canine Behavior and Training Solutions, Pam Brown representing the Arcata Dog Park, soon to be in your neighborhood, and also Shannon Townsend, who's a volunteer with the Humboldt Spay Neuter Network, and Jimmy the feral kitten,
who was very well behaved.
Yeah,
she didn't even chime in. And this has been Thursday Night Talk. I'm your host, Linda Stansberry, and we will see you again in a couple of weeks. I will be here in a couple of weeks. Your other Thursday Night Talk host will be here next week. Thank you, everybody.
You have been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Linda Stansberry, and our pet panel this evening. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email Thursday Night Talk at khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Next week, Eric Kirk will host Thursday Night Talk. Thank you to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh!
Oh, my God.
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing. It looks empty. No, there's someone living back there.
He's a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil.
Fridays at 7 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. here on KHSU.
Support for KHSU comes from Stars Hamburgers, serving burgers, fish, chicken, specialty salads, and more. Open every day for lunch and dinner. Stars is located on G Street in Arcata and on Harrison Avenue in Eureka, across from the hospital. Donors to KHSU also include North Coast Brewing Company, proud to support jazz as an art form, jazz education, and